Good afternoon and welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. Today's program is the first of two shows that will focus on being ready to face a man-made or natural disaster and the health impacts that can follow from these events. The first show will explore how our state, Alaska, prepares for emergencies like these, whether it be a severe weather event, a pandemic, a tsunami, or even an attack on infrastructure like the pipeline. Our state is also special in that roughly half the population resides in Anchorage, and we also have many remote communities that could need help. How does the system stretch itself to accommodate this diversity of needs? Next week, the second show will focus on personal responsibility. How do you get ready to care for yourself and your family if an event does occur? What expectations do local and state emergency workers have of us? Can we just drive to the hospital if we have an issue? Can we call for a rescue? Where will you get food to eat and water to drink in an emergency? The news headlines are inundated with details of citizens in the Carolinas struggling even after Hurricane Florence has passed, as they wait for the water to recede and rebuilding to begin. The list of similar storms and recovery stories is long, from Maria over Puerto Rico to Katrina over the Gulf Coast, and on and on. Alaska's situation could be complicated by wintertime cold conditions. So are we ready? Here to discuss the state's emergency readiness are our three guests, and I would like to welcome Sandra LeClaire. Hi, Sandra.
Hi, good afternoon.
You are the, big title, Emergency Program Manager, Preparedness, Department of Health and Social Services, Division of Public Health, or also known as HERO.
Correct.
Which is not a bad idea, actually, given the job you have to do. We also have Charles Pelton. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Really happy to have you. You're with the Division of Public Health, Emergency Programs, basically education and outreach and exercises.
That is correct.
So we're going to learn in the show that we exercise a lot. We practice a lot. That's one of the things the state does. And finally, we have Sean Murphy, who is chair of the Joint Medical Emergency Preparedness Group. Whew. It's a big one.
That's just one of my side hats. I'm also the Emergency Preparedness Coordinator for Alaska Regional Hospital, as well as our EMS liaison.
Okay. So we'll unpack all that as we go along. I do want to let our listeners know that your calls are welcome. If you have questions about emergency preparedness, remember next week we're going to deal with personal responsibility. This show is about how is the state ready? In other words, is there peace of mind to be had by knowing all the preparations that the state of Alaska participates in? So if you have questions about that, we'd love to hear from you. You can give us a call here in Anchorage at 550-8433. Statewide, the number is 1-888-353-5752. And we do welcome your email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. I'll give out our numbers a couple times during the hour. And I want to remind you that we will podcast this show on alaskapublic.org. So things like emergency preparedness, there may be tips in today's show and next week's show that you want to review. And we'll have the show's podcast as well as useful links for you related to emergency preparedness. So just remember alaskapublic.org. Okay, so let's get started on our topic. We've got a lot to cover. Sandra, I'm going to start with you, mostly because you were forced into being the overview person, right? But because of your role. First, tell me, what is your job, and how did your career lead you to doing this work? So what are you responsible for?
So I am the manager of the Health Emergency Response Operations Unit within the state of Alaska, and our role is healthcare and public health medical preparedness, response, recovery. And so we support the healthcare system, we support public health entities in preparing for and responding to disasters, medical surge incidents, pandemics, mass fatalities, things that occur that have a health and medical component to them. So that is our role, and I lead that team. Prior to coming to the state of Alaska, I worked for the Blood Bank of Alaska, and I was the assistant director of operations. So I sort of worked in the critical resource area of healthcare before I came over and started doing this.
Mm-hmm. Are you a lifelong Alaskan, or did opportunity bring you here?
I am not a lifelong Alaskan. I grew up on the East Coast, and I graduated from college and wanted to do something different and wanted to experience something exciting. And I looked on a map and pointed to Alaska and came here for what was going to be a 2-year adventure. And 18 years later, I am married and have my career here. And
set
this is where I live
down.
Now. This
set
is my home.
Yeah. Yes. I have a similar story. So, I wanted to know, is there a field of study for emergency preparedness? You mentioned college, and I thought, oh, I wonder if it began all the way back then.
There is. It's not where I chose to study back then, but there is a emergency management study field, and certainly it's expanding and growing and developing in response to the disasters we've experienced and how we engage with them as a country. So yes, emergency management is absolutely a field of study.
You can study it and get ready. I'm going to go over to Charles just because we want to hear from everybody first. Charles, what is your job in emergency response, and what did you do in life to get ready for that job? Well, I mean, did all roads lead to emergency preparedness for you?
You know, I guess in a way, maybe it did. I spent time in the service. I was in the United States Navy, and I had an opportunity to choose my last place to go to where I was going to retire. And, well, we saw this thing in Alaska that was available. So we came up here to Alaska, had a great time. And after following me around for 26 years, I let my wife decide where we were going to move after retirement, which was to stay here because she loved it here and so did I. So here we are. And in the United States Navy, I did a lot of exercises. I planned a lot of different training, a lot of different events. And when I got out, and this job was open. I applied for it along with so many other people because it's a great position I have. I think I have the best job in the world.
Glad you feel that way.
Oh, it's great. I get to be creative in my developing.
Not everyone in this room agrees, so they think they have the best job. Okay, but go ahead.
Well, I get to be creative in developing these exercises within certain parameters. So I have some very clear guidance on what needs to get done. And yet I'm still able to have some creativity in how to make those things happen, how to develop them. So I'm having a great time, and I work with Sandra and her team. Uh-huh. I'm part of her team, and we work it together.
So you get to dream up nightmare scenarios are practice sessions for...
And great exercise names.
And great exercise names. But sometimes it's not a nightmare scenario. Sometimes it's more of an uncomfortable scenario that we go to. So it runs a whole gambit.
So we'll talk more about that, because I think that helps people envision how do you get ready for an emergency. You imagine them and you practice them. So, but we'll be back to that. Sean, we're to you. You are a nurse. First, I want to know, how did you become a nurse? When and how?
Oh, so actually I lived in Alaska in Girdwood in 88, 89, right after my first degree in college, which did not do anything for me other than make me a really good waiter. I was speech communication.
Oh.
And so I went back to college after speaking with my parents, who were both nurses, and I said I wanted a mobile hot job that I can continually learn and I can help people. And they say that's nursing, actually. So that's how I ended up being a nurse.
Uh-huh. And then you what is your job? You rattled off several levels of responsibility.
The slash jobs, we call
that. Yes, slash jobs. Okay.
So my job for the hospital at Alaska Regional Hospital is I am the emergency preparedness specialist, emergency management specialist. I'm also the EMS liaison. So I prepare for the hospital's response and mitigation of any sort of disaster that we can foresee. I work with the community, I work with the state, and plan, exercise, etc. I'm also the EMS liaison for the hospital.
And emergency medical services.
Yeah, emergency medical services. And I interact with them to formalize or make better our relationships and our working with EMS.
Let me ask you, are you talking about firefighters and all of that?
Firefighters, okay. Police,
paramedics.
In the
Anchorage or in the state?
Primarily in the Anchorage area.
Okay.
But I also work with the FBI on occasion, and I work with people out in the valley as well.
Okay. And now to the big... The big one, the how many letters does it have? J-M?
E-P-G.
Okay, tell us what that one is, because I'm planning on talking more about that later.
Sure.
But it, in essence, it is the fact that things trickle downhill, things trickle to Anchorage. I guess all roads lead to Rome. If there's something major, this area would need to be very, very... So that agency or that working group really worries about...
The local stuff. So, Tip O'Neill said that all politics is local, and the FEMA doctrine is that all disasters are local. And so what we do at JMEPG, and I happen to be the this year's chair, is that we gather together and we say, what worries us the most? How can we plan and exercise to prepare ourselves for what worries us the most, and what resources can we share amongst ourselves, not least of all our personal relationships, to, again, shorten the distance between the event and the response and the recovery. Okay. So I work with all of the, it's mostly geographical, it's the area, it's Anchorage area, and it's the valley, and I work with the hospitals and the medical providers, as well as the state and the municipality, to break down silos of information. So we know what we each have, we know what we're capable of, and we know who's in charge. So I don't have to be handing out a business card in the event of the next disaster. Mm. I can actually call Sandra, I can call mm-hmm. Charles, both mm-hmm. of whom are on my speed dial already.
Kind of a pre-connection.
And they know who's on the other end of the line, which makes a big difference with yeah. local emergency response.
Good, good, good. All right, so we're going to come back and talk about everybody's areas of expertise, but I'm going to go back to Sandra and just an overview question for you. We're in an era of tight budgets. We are an era of, a big political election coming up, and some people's answer is to cut the budget more. Other people have said we've cut the budget enough. But when you get to things like emergency services, I don't think people want to hear about budget cuts so much. So how is the state of Alaska faring? It may be that they can draw on federal reserves. I have no idea. But help us know whether budget cuts have added to the problem or how you're managing it.
Sure. Well, in the Health Emergency Response Operations Unit, we are supported by federal funds. And so we operate as state employees. We are a part of the state, but our funding is entirely federal funding. And so in that way, it's really that partnership between the state resources and the federal funding that allows us to operate and do what we do. And so really what happens at the state level and at the federal level matters to us mm-hmm. and matters to the ongoing strength of our programs. Mm-hmm. And certainly, you know, we ensure that whatever happens within either the state or the federal government, when our funding is received, we go through a process of prioritization to make sure that what we are doing aligns with what the greatest hazards are and what the greatest needs are in our state. And so mm-hmm. that's really the process that we would go through in response to whatever comes down from whatever entity is providing mm-hmm. that funding.
Okay. That is somewhat reassuring, I would say. by the way, if you've joined us, the topic today is emergency preparedness, but kind of on a statewide level. Next week's show is going to give you tips and advice and scenarios of how to be prepared on an individual personal level. So we welcome your calls if you have questions or comments at 550-8433 in Anchorage, statewide 1-888-353-5752, or email hometown@alaskapublic.org. Sandra, back to you. Before we started the show, I said I wanted to list the scariest things that could happen just because I think that gets people's attention. And so I just want to say we are covering, for example, 100 years ago, the Spanish flu devastated the state. Things are different now. An airplane could land from another continent and there could be something arriving. You know, so even though we might feel like we've come a long way over 100 years, we have different challenges. So pandemic is one. Tsunami, earthquake. Of course, we lived through the 1964 earthquake here. We've watched, you know, Japan go through a major earthquake and tsunami. I have thought a lot about our crumbling coastline and issues related to health and well-being of rural communities when, say, septic ponds are flood because of storm surges. Perhaps a cholera outbreak, something like that. Have I named all the scariest things? Let's see. Not long ago, we were talking about North Korea and whether it could hit the mainland, you know, with an anti-ballistic missile, or a ballistic missile, I guess you could say. So, you know, it seems like a dangerous world out there. Some of it man-made, some of it natural. Have I hit the things that scare you? And I am guessing that you look at all of these things and see commonalities, not the specific incident, but what happens in all of the, you know, and that's how you approach it. So tell us a little bit about that.
Absolutely. We go through hazard analysis in terms of determining what has happened most frequently in terms of disasters in Alaska and what are things that could happen. And so natural disasters are really one of the things that happen most frequently here, flooding, wildfires, which I don't think you mentioned, but certainly are an important part of life here.
a reasonable summer this year, but other parts of the U.S. did not, yes.
And when it happens, it can be very destructive to property, to life, to, you know, people being able to access what they need to mm-hmm. survive. And so when we're looking at those types of disasters, certainly the floods and the wildfires are things that could happen seasonally. But we recognize that, you know, the 1964 earthquake scenario is what we generally put out there as the catastrophic planning scenario, we call it. And then we kind of have a pandemic scenario that's also worst case scenario in terms of a public health impact. And so we do plan to those types of incidents. And, you know, I'm looking across the table at Sean because I know from the state's perspective and also from hospital perspective, while we look at each of these types of disasters and we say, well, flooding will have one type of impact, wildfire may have a similar or another type of impact, we look at what are the potential impacts of a disaster, and then how do we structure our response to that? And so an evacuation from a hospital to an alternate
care site, which we exercised last spring,
that mm-hmm. is something that could happen in a result of
so
a flood.
So evacuating a whole hospital?
Sure, yeah, that's what we did. One of the exercises that Charles helped design for us and we executed was how quickly and how effectively can we notionalize, how can we, on paper at least, evacuate a hospital, and where would these people go, and how could we get in touch with the other providers and the alternative care sites to mobilize these folks?
Okay.
Because the partners that you need for evacuation are the partners who you may need for a massive surge when you can't evacuate, and may be the partners that you need when there's infrastructure damage. Mm-hmm. And so really, those partnerships are incredibly important regardless of the type of hazard. So the hazards ground us, right? They remind us what we're doing this for, and they keep us vigilant. But the impacts and the partnerships and the planning are the things we do day to day to prepare ourselves for this.
Mm-hmm. Okay. One of the things we talked about while we were getting ready for the show was that we have learned a lot in the last 10 years, and it was stated so assertively, but I'd like to flesh that out a little bit. Like, what have we learned? Is it a process because we have new tools that we've been able to learn more, or enough new things happened that we learned from them, you know, the events that maybe hadn't happened before? What do you mean by the fact that we have learned so much? And I'm kind of looking at Sean.
Okay, fair enough. Okay. So one of the other side jobs that I do is I'm a member of a federal disaster team. And since 2004, forgive me, I've been doing this. And so I've actually been to most of the major catastrophic events, or, you know, the earth, the...
In other words, you go and work these events?
Sure. I responded to Katrina, Rita, Gustav, Ike, Haiti, Sandy. And I was in Hurricane Irma recently. So basically what we do on a federal level, a local level, a state level, is every time we have an exercise, every time we have an event, we get together afterwards and we do an after action report. And we say, what worked? What didn't work? What can we improve? And where did we fall down on our face? And usually it's the where did we fall down on our face that everyone else remembers and that we really, really try to improve on.
So without calling out anybody's mistakes, because that's not the point, what kind of things did we learn that we weren't responding well to that we changed?
Okay, one of the things that's really important is that when everybody evacuates from a hurricane, you can send all the federal assets you want into, but if there's no one local who can tell you where the problem is, and if there's no capacity to actually call them because all the cell towers are down and all we're using is cell towers, then you can't move forward with your response. So we've diversified. We'd make sure we've got really strong local partners that I've seen that advancing over the years. And we're also diversifying our communication capacity. You know, we're using satellite radios, we're using ham radios, where before we might have gone towards just landlines. And if the power lines and the telephone lines are down, we can't communicate. And if we can't communicate, we can't get to people to where they need to be. So that's just one specific.
So if the cell towers are down and the landlines are down, what do you use?
We have a number of satellite phones available.
Phones.
We will be installing a ham radio system in the hospital this year.
Ham radio?
Yeah.
Wow. Wow, tried and true.
Kicking it old school.
Yeah, okay. Okay, very good. How about, is Sandra or Charles, anything to add to what we have learned over the last 10 years?
I think another important aspect of our learning over the past 10 years has to engage in inclusive and accessible planning. So really thinking about how do we ensure that the needs of all people are addressed by the type of emergency management activities we're engaging in. And so that could be something as simple as making sure that the way that you've set up your alternate care sites and mass care shelters allows people of all different abilities to walk down the aisles and access what they need, that you have some access to multiple languages, that you have access to assistive technology, just things that allow people to access what they need. That's incredibly important because we know that they are at risk if they can't access what they need. And so that's been a very important part and lessons learned of the last 10 years, probably before that, and certainly still going. We're always learning from the next or the last exercise and or real event.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we're going to come back and talk more about how Alaska is prepared and continues to prepare for health emergencies that are the result of man-made or natural disasters. And you're welcome to join us. You're listening to Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy. We're talking scary topics today, really, truly scary topics like disasters and the health impacts after a disaster. We've certainly seen headlines from Florence, from Katrina, from Maria, Sandy, of what happens when the streets flood, the systems go down, and things become quite dire. And in preparation for winter, we decided to have a show about Alaska's, how ready is Alaska, and next week we're going to follow it with a show about how should you be prepared. So in the studio, I just want to remind you who my guests are. We have Sandra LeClaire, Emergency Program Manager for the state of Alaska, Charles Pelton, who works on really exercises, how do we practice these things, and Sean Murphy, who has many roles, emergency response at Alaska Regional, but also EMS response in South Central, but also the idea that all roads lead to Rome, a major statewide disaster, a lot of people would be coming to Anchorage for help, and how do you prepare for that kind of a surge? So that's Sean Murphy. So Charles, you got off on the first segment, so I'm back to you. You mentioned your military background and also that you did a lot of exercises when you were in the helping the military prepare. I have a suspicion that Alaskans might be thinking, we're in Fat City here because we've got, you know, lots of military presence here. We're strategically important in the world. If something really bad happens, we have the military. And I'm sure there's some truth to that, but let's unpack that a little bit and help people think about it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, our military here is a huge presence. We have Army and Air Force both here and up in Fairbanks. And also, we have a few other places around the state that they have.
The Coast Guard and Kodiak.
Coast Guard has a great presence here in the state. So we have a lot of assets here. And as Sandra was talking about, some of our partnerships that we build and as we go through our planning processes through our exercises, we always bring in our partners from the federal and Department of Defense to participate in our planning cycle. We build our relationships there. We start going through the type of things that we might need those guys to support us in, where the state of Alaska would reach out to them and under what circumstances. So we have a great partnership with those guys. They have a lot of capability. They're very diverse. And with that capability and diversity, they have many, many things they can bring to an organization or to a disaster. Of course, we try to start locally, and then as Sean was talking about, you start locally and you go to the state And then from the state, you start building out. And
then you don't just call Uncle Sam.
No.
Right.
That's not the first call.
But we do build up to that. And there are times when if we had a 1964 earthquake type thing, they would be coming in very early. And they would also be coming in, you know, right away to do the initial support to make sure that they can do as much as they can to save lives and property, but focus on what's going to be happening here. So our partnerships that we do build through these exercise programs have been invaluable to us.
Mm-hmm. I think when I met Sandra earlier to sort of get ready for the show, one thing I took away from it is that the military is here on the ground, but they also have responsibilities globally. Our military here in Alaska has global responsibilities. So our needs here need to get filtered through some of those other demands on them. It doesn't mean they aren't there, and it doesn't mean that they can't respond. But for example, if there was an attack someplace else and an earthquake here, they might be pulled in two directions. Am I kind of reading that right?
Yeah, yes, you are. They would be pulled in a couple directions. However, our military is actually quite large. So there may be other assets, other locations that could respond to an attack so that our local forces here may be able to serve Alaska and Alaskans. That said, I think what we have here is a very strong partnership with them and with other organizations, Northern Command down in Colorado Springs, some other places that have come up here and have seen what they have, what we have here in Alaska, what our challenges are, how we respond to those challenges, and how we are able to power through many of those things. So we have a very diverse group that we can reach out to.
Mm-hmm.
To
a
include
big net.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and mm-hmm. there are entryway into that. But as you said, there is a way to get to that. And if we start to have a disaster that starts to cascade, starts to have other things happen, that can build into a larger response that would require Department of Defense and federal response.
Yeah. You know, going in the other direction from not the national assistance we can get, but the local assistance. I mentioned this the other day that there was a very compelling story. I think it was in print in the New York Times, and then it was a podcast at the New York Times, and it had to do with really the local response and the expectation that, you know, you can push the responsibility down. And this particular situation was a woman who just had surgery. She was doing fine, but then a disaster struck, a flood, and her husband started calling 911 because she was developing symptoms. And I think he had to call 911 five times, and he might have been helped eventually by volunteers rather than 911. And in the analysis, and again, this is one story, it suggested that assumptions were made about what was available locally, so that the fire station locally would have boats that could rescue people, and that turned out not to be true. So then I wonder, you know, as responsibility is laid out in a major plan, what safeguards do we have that the resources are actually there, the boats are there if we need them, or, you know, I, as we work to combine the local, the state, and the national, what can we tell people about that? And I'm not suggesting that would happen here. It was a compelling story. It happened once, but it did bring to mind the idea of what could happen.
And those are the types of incidents that we all try to learn from. You know, I know Sean and I were both, and Charles were all aware of that story, and we try to take lessons from the disasters and the incidents that happen in other states. And so that's very important. In terms of the availability of resources, one of the things that we go back to is one of Sean's initial statements regarding partnerships and planning and collaboration. You know, while there are a lot of challenges in Alaska, we have this great advantage of being small enough in terms of our personnel that we know each other and we do sit at the table together. And that keeps us from making assumptions about the types of things that people have or organizations. We really go to these hospitals. We really get boots on the ground and we talk to them and we walk around their facilities with them. We go visit the police department or EMS. We try to all work together to understand what the capabilities are in that community so that we can have a real comprehensive response. You look at a place like Seward, Alaska, which is building a local level coalition that's dedicated to healthcare preparedness. One of the things that they do is really make sure they understand in their community as a group what do we have here and how can we leverage that before the state comes in and then before the feds come in? And that's something that's absolutely invaluable to this process of preparing, is starting at that local level and then having the kind of connections that we are fortunate enough to have with hospitals here, which is boots on the ground, setting up the tents with you, practicing with you, and really understanding what your capability is. That's how you get out of making assumptions. You engage in that planning and you sit face to face, or you get on the phone and you check your assumptions and you communicate.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
If I could.
Yeah, I was just going to turn to you, Sean, because I thought being the guy that worries about EMS.
Sure. And so I could actually speak to that directly in that a couple of years ago when I was supervising the emergency department in my hospital, we had a couple of very critical pieces of equipment go down and their replacement was not going to be forthcoming anytime soon. And so we were in a bad way. But coincidentally, a year or two before, I'd gone to the Hail Borealis conference. I'd actually toured the HERO facilities, and I knew that they actually had those pieces of equipment on hand. And so I made a call out of my phone to the folks at HERO, and I said, do you have these, and may I borrow them? And so it wasn't calling the feds. I was calling a friend of mine saying, I'm in a hard way. Can you help me out?
Mm-hmm.
And it was that informal. And I had those pieces. We didn't need them, but had we needed them, we would have been in real trouble being without them.
Right. Okay. That is reassuring to me. And it does make sense that the inventory has to be broad. You have to know what tools are there before you expect people. I'm just going to remind folks the topic today is emergency preparedness on a statewide level. How is the state of Alaska ready to handle an emergency? Next week, we're going to do personal responsibility in an emergency. And we've got guests from the state. We've got Sandra LeClaire, who is the emergency program manager. It's probably a shortened version of your title, but we're in the right general area.
Yes.
Charles Pelton, who really does a lot of creating of the exercises to practice for disasters that might happen, and then the health impacts afterwards. And then Sean Murphy, who is responsible for if everything breaks and it all comes to Anchorage to get fixed, he's the guy that's going to try to sort it out.
Yeah,
that's
Sean. Wow, huh? You might be overstating it just
okay.
a touch.
Can
I get a clip of that from my mom? Just after?
Yes, you can. And again, we appreciate you joining in with your questions or comments, 550-8433 in Anchorage, or we can take an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. And I do have an email. It looks like more of a comment, but perhaps you guys can react to it. This is someone who's familiar with emergency drills. He says, I was involved in emergency training drills, fire, oil spills along the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. The biggest lesson learned, people will respond exactly as trained, good, bad, or otherwise, depending on the support provided to and for the training program and training infrastructure. So it's a big plug for it's worth it to train.
Yeah.
any response to that?
Well, absolutely. As we go through some of our planning for exercises, we will often decide that we really need to make sure that we have those different type of lessons out there that have already happened to understand what happened and how we can overcome those or incorporate those in our planning process. And again, as Sandra and Sean have said, those partnerships are just invaluable. Rudy Giuliani, when 9/11, stated that even though they never, ever ran a drill or an exercise of planes flying into the World Trade Centers, they knew who to call, they knew who to talk to. And it was all the way down through their entire structure on who needed to be informed, what kind of things need to be said to them, where could we reach out and get things. So he's right on point in that as you train, even if it's something you've never trained to, you'll still respond as you have been trained and as you've been educated.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And to underscore and really point out the importance of this comment, the day-to-day support in a non-disaster environment of these types of training programs, of these types of exercises, that is the key to being prepared for it. And if you wait until it happens to then turn around and expect staff or the people who work with you to be able to effectively respond at that point, if you have not invested in the time and effort effort to get them ready, it's not a reasonable expectation. And that's why we do what we do, and that's why the hospitals do what they do, and the other healthcare centers, and our partnerships with public health nursing. This is why we get together and do what we do, because between labs and epidemiology and nursing and hospitals, we're all coming together and practicing and training. And he's absolutely right that these types of they become muscle memory. These exercises, these types of training, they become a muscle memory that then you can execute when the time comes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I wanted to build on what Sean said earlier with the upcoming Hail Borealis Forum. We only put this forum together every 2 years. And it's an opportunity to bring people together from all over the state to not only learn about cutting edge lessons learned, but to talk to each other, to network together. And October 23rd through the 25th, it's coming up soon here in Anchorage. And we really want the community who's listening and who's engaged in this to take part in it, because this is one of the many opportunities we provide that really allows people to learn from national disasters that have occurred, Puerto Rico, fires in California, flooding in Texas. All those folks are going to be there. One of the individuals who took part in the cave rescue in Thailand is going to be there. And it's all about how do we bring people together to be able to execute these seemingly impossible tasks mm-hmm. of supporting people in getting health care after a disaster. Mm-hmm. So I really want to encourage people to come to that in addition to the day-to-day opportunities they have to exercise and train.
You know, I do have a link to the Hail Borealis website where it talks about this conference. Tell us, is it open to the public?
Absolutely.
Is it free, or do you need to register? Do you know the details? I know you're not responsible for this conference, but do you know those details?
I'll take that question. Absolutely. So the Hail Borealis Forum, hailborealis.com, it's $99 to register. It does require registration. There's over 50 courses in 2.5 days. And for those who need continuing education credits, there's up to 15.5 continuing education credits. And so we highly encourage individuals to look online. The entire agenda is posted. They can get to know our speakers. They can get to know our agenda and register to come learn with us. Mm-hmm. Not only are we putting on this conference, but we learn from it as well. Mm-hmm. And we learn from our local partners who we bring in, who use that as an opportunity to sit down face to face and really have some great discussions about what's happening in your community and what kinds of training opportunities and lessons learned can we share with each other. So we had a recent coalition meeting where, which is a statewide healthcare coalition. It's focused on emergency preparedness and disaster response. And Cordova provided us with an amazing after action and lessons learned from some of the experiences that they had in response to the recent earthquake and tsunami warning. And so really some of the best lessons that we learn are from each other. Mm-hmm. You know, we bring in national experts, but that was an invaluable opportunity to learn. So again, just really encouraging folks to take part in that so that we can all learn from each other.
And just tell me, Hail Borealis, is that someone's name, or does it mean Hail the Northern Lights?
Glad you asked that question. It means Healthy North.
Oh, thank you. Okay, I feel much better.
And that is our goal. That's the end game of everything we do,
is
supporting a healthy North.
All right. I do have an email. It was a caller who left an email with our engineer about what they are interested in. It goes back to the military question. So I'm looking at you, Charles, although I don't know if everybody may want to chime in. Having a military in Alaska makes us a target of nuclear attack. Can you ask your guests what city is most likely to be a target, specifically Anchorage versus the Matsu?
Well, you know, I don't know that we would necessarily be a strategic target. There are, without going too deep into how we think the something like that would unfold, I'm unaware of any current threats for nuclear attack to the United States, to include Alaska. And if you look at where we have a lot of our population, a lot of our other assets, I'm not sure that a nuclear-capable nation would look to attacking Alaska when what we do have a great capability up here, and it's a lot for us because of our population and the fact we're so spread out and they have that those incredible capabilities to move around our state like they can. I'm not sure that would be something that they would be looking at right away. So I don't know what the strategy of the adversary would be to attack Alaska.
Mm-hmm. Sandra, do you want to chime in?
Well, from a health and medical perspective, we certainly don't make the decisions on who might be more of a target than another or who's more at risk than someone else. But what we do is work with hospitals on things like preparation for chemical, biological, radiological incidents, for example.
Sure.
And so, again, this goes back to whatever the risks might be, you look at what the impacts are and we plan the impacts.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, Sean could tell you that his hospital has plans for, you know, making sure that they have some hazardous materials response capability. And that's something that all hospitals do
mm-hmm.
because you don't know what in what way it's going to impact you. So,
mm-hmm.
again, we look at what could impact the health and medical wellness of individuals in Alaska and how can we collectively work together to make sure that that's provided for after any kind of incident.
Mm-hmm. You know, just in defense of the caller, I mean, the headlines about North Korea were scary.
Sure.
And you sort of, it kind of catches you up short, like, gee, we hadn't been thinking that that was a possibility. Sean, anything for you to add?
Well, so basically, when we all start this, we do what's called a hazard vulnerability analysis. And then we plan and drill and exercise according to the biggest risks, the biggest need. And a lot of times, it's the biggest bang for our buck. So if I'm looking to exercise, I'm not necessarily exercising for a nuclear blast, but I may exercise for an actually explosive blast. If I'm thinking about in terms of pandemic, that would also play into the possibility of defending us against an attack with an intentional release,
like some kind of
like
I don't
a sarin
know, chemical,
or chemical attack,
work, uh-huh.
or mm-hmm. you know. So that's kind of what we do. We spend less time thinking about specifics, say what happens with North Korea, you know, hits us with a nuclear attack, and more thinking, okay, what happens if there's an explosion? What happens if there's a pandemic? What happens
mm-hmm.
if
chemical warfare?
Chemical warfare,
yeah.
And much of that would translate into our response.
So. Sure, and that's exactly it.
Yeah. Well, we need to take another tiny break. You're listening to Hometown Alaska, and I'm Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm feeling very safe and secure here in the studio. We're talking about emergency preparedness for the state of Alaska. And I have Sandra LeClaire and Charles Pelton here from the state of Alaska and Sean Murphy, who has federal connections and Alaska Regional Hospital connections and local EMS connections. I can't even recite them all. But at any rate, we have been talking about and taking some questions from listeners about you know, how is Alaska prepared to respond? And I thought with sort of the warming ocean, the open waters to the Northwest Passage, and even was it Crystal Serenity in 2016 that made the first trip that went and landed in New York and went across the top of the globe in a passage that wasn't possible recently until we had sort of warming northern latitudes. So, Charles, I'm kind of looking at you. There was this Crystal Serenity was the name of the ship, and I remember reading in the paper at the time when it was going to make its trip that there were some exercises and practices that were tied. What if that ship went belly up? How would Kotzebue be prepared to deal with it? Or what if it hit a shoal and had to be evacuated? What community would be prepared to do that? So there were some exercises around that. Could you tell us a little bit about that, Charles?
Absolutely. It was a exercise that was initiated by Northern Command. They called it the Arctic Chinook. And what they did is the scenario was that a small cruise ship actually had a fire on board and began to sink off of, I think it was Kotzebue was what we ended up going to. When we went to Kotzebue, we went in there to support the local community. We went in there to support the saving of lives and moving individuals from Kotzebue down to Anchorage for further support. In addition to that, we did this during America's, United States, chairmanship of the Arctic Council. We had many different nations up there observing and participating. We had Canada, Finland came in to observe and participate. We had a lot of different,
A lot of Arctic nations are wondering, how do you prepare for this when we haven't maybe had to worry about it in the past so much?
Right. So we were able to go through that whole process, how we would leverage that which is in Kotzebue and how we would be able to set up. First, they set up tents on the beach. The scenario was that we needed to shelter them overnight in an Arctic condition. And once we went for the first night, then they started flowing to Manilik Hospital there in Kotzebue and also down to Anchorage. We did this in partnership not only with our federal and state partners, but also with the cruise ship industry. They participated in it. They gave us expertise, knowledge, insight on what needed to happen. And we were able to go ahead and we showed that we have a very good capacity. Maybe that's a better way to say it. We have a good capacity and capability, and we found some things that we can work on, things that we can improve upon.
Mm-hmm. Any lessons learned there that you took away?
Oh, I think so. I think communications on how we were going to do the movement, how we were going to integrate with the local community and a local healthcare facility on how that would happen. And then once we did the movement back down to Anchorage, how we would do the transportation within Anchorage to those basic facilities and how we would engage and bring into our exercise program or to a real life situation a private entity such as the cruise ship industry.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting. Yeah. I mean, I've read stories that even though trade and shipping lines might become available, unless those companies are sure that in a disaster there would be the capacity for rescue, they might not take those risks yet until they're reassured of that. So, Sandra, anything to add there? We're talking about rural Alaska. In this case, it's rural Alaska supporting, not needing, but supporting a crisis off its coastline.
Absolutely. I think that rural Alaska certainly recognizes that when they stand up in response to what we call a medical surge incident, that they may be on their own for a little while just because of geography and timing and weather. And so when we talk about planning, the planning matrix might look a little bit different in Anchorage and Matsu and Juneau than it does in Kotzebue and Nome and other places that are a little more difficult to get to, depending on, again, like I said, weather and other aspects. So they really engage in how do we surge our hospital and get ready to respond with what we have here. And, you know, I've mentioned hospitals several times, and Sean and Charles, we've all mentioned hospitals, but I also want to emphasize that whether it's in these small rural communities or in more urban communities, healthcare response is not just about hospitals. It's
about, you couldn't say that better,
dialysis centers. It's about pediatricians.
Pharmacies.
It's about pharmacies. Mm-hmm. It is about the other entities in that community that provide healthcare. They are so important to this response. It is absolutely vital that they are also integrated and planning with their communities. Because after a disaster happens, people, if they do not have access to healthcare, will not stay in those communities. And those types of healthcare facilities, your primary care, et cetera, those folks provide that critical health capability that people need. And it also helps to relieve some of the surge on the hospitals when those folks are integrated and they are willing and ready to surge as well. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about healthcare system preparedness, I just want to be clear that we are really talking about a community's response.
Public, private,
can
government.
I take this minute to do a shameless plug?
Okay.
Okay, so one of our biggest emphasis since 2016, the federal government has required that non-traditional, non-hospital, entities become part of their local healthcare coalitions. And so that's one of our biggest goals with JMEPG is to get the surgery centers, the dialysis centers, the long-term nursing facilities, all of the special needs facilities into our system, because they may not have a hospital at their beck and call, but they have staff at their beck and call. They have the facilities at their beck and call. They have supplies. Mm-hmm. So the shameless plug, forgive me, we are doing what we call the JMEPG boot camp. We're repeating it. It's on January 8th at Alaska Regional Hospital, and that's inviting and bringing new members into the fold and showing them what our capacities are and how we can benefit. They can benefit from joining us as well.
So even like a doc in the box facility might go there,
or
kidney dialysis center.
Every single person that joins us at the table is probably 10 fewer patients that have to go to the hospital for care that can be gotten elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. And I also want to take this opportunity to identify the incredible critical importance of our tribal healthcare system in response and what incredible partners they are at the table. Whether it's our work with the emergency managers over at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, who are absolutely phenomenal and work very closely with the state and local facilities, to our community health aides, behavioral health aides, our dental aides on the ground. These folks are absolute critical importance to first response. They are the ones who are there when it happens, and they are the ones who respond when it happens. And so those entities are also incredibly important to this. And on a day-to-day basis, certainly they are always the first responders in their communities. But when it comes to medical surges and disasters, they become one of the most important liaisons for health into the community and understanding what the community needs, mm-hmm. and what they have and how we can build on those resources.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to raise an issue that we haven't talked about. It was on my mind, and I think I mentioned it when we got ready for the show. But the question came in from a listener: what is the threat of major solar flares and the effect on our electronics? So that opens up sort of the things beyond physical wounds to the body, but a system that can't function, cell phones. And I don't know who wants to take it, but I know you practice for it.
Sure.
We talked a little bit about that.
So I can't speak specifically to EMP, but I'm going to go back to my diatribe of if communications goes down, which it is possible, we have a fairly fragile communication infrastructure system, then we are all in trouble. So I think the biggest thing that this person could benefit from would be redundancy. Do you have a landline? Do you have a cell phone? Do you have someone out of state that you can call or text, as opposed to texting across town, which is often one of the first systems to go down.
Oh, so you might have access outside the state?
Correct. So if you, one of the things, like town to town, across town, the towers may be down, but I may be more lucky getting a text, preferably a text than a phone call. It's a lot easier to get it out of state and have it bounce back. So that's one thing.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Anybody else in terms of, we rely on these systems so much. How many people do I know that don't have a landline anymore? Yeah. Because it was a way to save a little money, and everybody's got a cell phone. But I still have my landline because I'm afraid of the cell towers going down. From a military perspective or from a training perspective, do you look at this, Charles?
Well, we do. Matter of fact, we recently did a redundant communications exercise with our friends down in Kenai Borough Peninsula, the hospitals down there, and also with the local emergency management down there. And we have one scheduled here in Anchorage that we're going to be doing with our medical facilities and with the municipality on what kind of communication systems there are, what kind of redundancy do we have, how do we get to those things, how are our plans set up to move from one to another. So we are setting ourselves up through those redundant systems to be able to respond to these type of events.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I have a question that was just on my mind. You see throughout Anchorage, and I'm speaking really of Anchorage, but you do see a fair amount of homeless. You see, and with many precipitating influences on homeless people, including some mental health issues. And I really think about in a major disaster, they may or may not be plugged into a resource for help. And I guess I wonder, how do you think about that in a kind of the global view, perhaps the surge to Anchorage sure. kind of view, about folks who are homeless or, you know, experiencing mental illness but are not in a clinic setting or in any way where they're getting immediate help. How do you deal with that?
Sure.
And is that a large population or is that a small population? What do you think?
Well, if experience, and this is just prior disaster response, would show, it's a larger population than you'd expect. And that's while a lot of folks can maintain over the course of a normal day, those are a lot of the folks that will have breakdowns in their support system on when pressured. Recent research shows that people view hospitals as this beacon on the hill, and they may not have a specific medical problem, but they think to themselves, I'm going to go to the hospital and they're going to help me, whether it's with food, water, shelter, et cetera, et cetera. So what we're doing on a personal level and with JMEPG, we're looking to expand beyond specifically medical capacity. You know, do we have partnerships with the Brother Francis? Do we have partnership with the American Red Cross? Trying to think a little bit outside the box, knowing that folks are going to come to us whether we're prepared or not, we might as well be prepared. But that's mm-hmm. absolutely the case.
Yeah. Anything else to add, Sandra?
Well, and certainly we know that anyone, including those who may be homeless or in many other circumstances, when something happens, they go to the place that they are most comfortable with, that they've received services from previously. And so if their main area of healthcare is the hospital, that's where they're going, even if the advice is not to go right now unless you're critically injured. They will go to a provider that they are familiar with. And so we know that in terms of them proactively engaging in healthcare services, they go to where they're familiar with. But I think that, you know, your question also has some aspects to it of how do you engage public messaging to a wide audience that includes folks who are hard to find and hard to make contact with. And that's definitely a challenge of disasters. You have to use not only redundant communications, as which we talked about earlier, you have to use redundant methods to get in touch with people. And whether you're talking about your radio and your television and your printed material, you also may end up sending folks out there to be ambassadors, to talk to people, go to the shelters and some of those places to ensure your message is getting out. So you have to use some creative methods when you really start expanding your public information. We have a great public information team at the state, and each hospital has public information officers, as do many organizations. But you're also utilizing the services of social services organizations and many others who already have those connections. Again, we're going to circle all the way back to where we were in the beginning, which is the relationships that you build with these organizations now will allow you to reach out to the right organizations and then further reach out to these folks who need help.
That's it.
And so that's where you just see the communications and the relationships play a part in every single one of these questions that we've talked about today.
Mm-hmm. You know, one other one, we have just a couple minutes left, but the opioid epidemic really comes to mind because you have a situation with people who are on a day-to-day kind of survival mode, and a disaster could really cause issues with that. There we go.
Maybe that'll be for next week's topic.
Yeah,
there
maybe
we go.
I'll try to bring it up next week. So, gosh, we are out of time. I would like to thank our guests, all experts on how Alaska prepares to handle emergencies. That was Sandra LeClaire and Charles Pelton from the state of Alaska and Sean Murphy from Alaska Regional and
Parts Beyond.
And, of course, our listeners and callers who had interesting questions. I'll be back as your host next Monday when we feature part two of our look at emergency readiness. What is your individual citizen responsibility to be ready to manage an emergency? Find us on the web at alaskapublic.org. Aman Swenson and Dave Waldron were our audio engineers today. I'm Kathleen McCoy. Thanks for joining us on Hometown Alaska.
Home Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.